It's December 2024, and last month, Women in Sport held our 40th anniversary conference in London. My name is Julia George. I'm a journalist, broadcaster, and former gymnast. And in today's podcast, I want to share some conference highlights. Today, we'll hear from three high-profile women in sport, talking about their vision for the future and what makes them mad about the speed of progress towards true equality. There's Paula Dunn, MBE. She's the first female head coach appointed by UK Athletics. Also, Lisa O'Keefe, MBE, is the Secretary General of the International Working Group on Women and Sport. And Kelly Simmons, OBE, who spent 30 years at the Football Association, latterly as the Director of the Women's Professional Game. Between them, they face down prejudice, misogyny and discrimination on their way to the top. Welcome to the Women in Sport podcast. This conference, as you all know, is about a new era in women's sport. We know we belong. We know our girls belong. And a growing number of men know it too. And we're going to hear from some of you, thank you, on the stage today. But rightly, we start with the women. Individual stories, wider truths, and a vision for the future. When she was a young girl, Paula Dunn and her teacher, Mr. Heal, realised that she could run really fast. After a dazzling career as a GB sprinter, she agreed to do some coaching, just for 6 weeks, mind. It's been the longest 6 weeks ever, hasn't it, Paula?
Absolutely, yeah. Still there today.
Still there today. Lisa O'Keefe was a rugby player who achieved that dream that every sports person dreams of, playing for her country. Only to rupture her ACL, she was immediately dropped and given no support to rehab. She did make it back after 6 long years, and she competed in 2 further World Cups. It was good people and good luck that got her back. The system failed you, didn't it?
100% it failed me.
Kelly Simmons went from the little girl who wasn't allowed to play football to the director of development for the women's and men's game. Kelly, you felt injustice before you could even say the word feminism, is that fair?
Yes, I desperately wanted to play football, wasn't allowed, and it took till 2022 when the Lionesses won the Euros to call out the inequality of opportunity for football in schools, and there is a government commitment, there's brilliant work being done by the FA and Barclays, but there's still a gender gap, which is incredible.
Let's take you all back to being little girls. Paula, let's talk about that first athletics meet. You said to me that you were one of 2 black kids in a sea of white faces and you just felt like you didn't want to embarrass yourself. You did rather better than that, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I'm also one of 6 children. I've got 4 brothers. And I knew if I didn't do well that they would tease me mercilessly. So I knew I had to go out there and do well. But yeah, it was intimidating and it was really scary. But my dad, who worked nights, my parents had divorced, took me down to the track, and he said, usually when I was really excited going, got there, I was really scared, but didn't know I was scared, and said I felt ill, and he said, I've got to run. I had no option because he hadn't slept because he worked nights. So I'd gone on and competed there, and just went through it, and the first race I'd won, and I thought, oh, it's not too bad. I've beaten some children here. I looked around, and I was in trainers. I thought my trainers were really super good, duper ones that I wanted, Dunlop Green Flash. But everybody else had spikes and blocks. So I sat there with this boy called Roy. Then we did the semi-finals and I got through to that. And then we got to the final and I sat with my dad. And by this time, a few of the kids were just coming over talking like children do. And my dad said to me, by the time this finished, every kid would want what you've got. And I said, Dunlop Green Flash. He went, no, just go and run. And then I ran and won that race. Got a 99 on the way home. My brothers were super proud. And yeah, that's probably how it all started for me.
As you progressed through your career, well, even just as a teenager, you saw what so many of us have seen and still see now. And that's your teenage friends dropping out. What happened to the girls who started running with you?
All of them. So it was about 6 or 7 of us who went down to the track. And all of them, bar me, was standing at the end of 12 months. and just didn't feel like they belonged. I mean, I always am slightly different because I've got four brothers, so I'm a little bit just resilient naturally. So when people say you're not going to do something, that's really good for me because I like to prove them wrong. So you get teased, and I was just able to withstand it. And so I just stuck at it, and as I say, all my friends one by one dropped out.
We'll come back to your career in a moment and talk about the difference between your experiences and those who are the men that were running at the same time, Linford Christie and people like that. But let's just go to another childhood. And we said at the beginning, Kelly, that you were that generation, I was that generation. We didn't get to play football at school. You wanted to, though, didn't you? Did you get to play when you were at primary school, and did it all change at secondary, or just didn't happen at all for you?
No, not at all. Not till I went to university, and then I captained the side and got my coaching qualifications and fell into football development by chance. The sports that I could see on TV were football, cricket, rugby. They were the ones I wanted to try, and they were exactly the ones that I wasn't allowed to play because they weren't deemed suitable.
Is that what drives you and has driven you through your career, the sense that this must not happen to another generation? They mustn't be made to feel from the get-go that they don't belong, this isn't their space, in the same way as it is for boys and men?
Yeah, no, absolutely. When I got the chance to go into the FA over 30 years ago, and it finally came out last year, I thought, when I reflect back on my career, and you know, you can imagine probably what it was like when I first went in there in terms of the sort of the culture and the support for women's football and the lack of investment and fight to put the whole sort of player pathway in from the England team, centres of excellence, participation programmes, etc. You know, it was a fight. But when I reflect back, I think my driver was making sure that girls get the opportunity that I didn't. And it's not just about them having the chance to play football, but it says so much, I think, about where girls and women are in society, about, you know, what's open and what's closed to them. And I think you can often look at where women are in society by how well they're doing in football. It seems to be like this sort of mirror, and I just thought, you know, we can smash those barriers down and we can genuinely show girls and boys that girls can do anything. It just felt more powerful than football itself.
Let's go across to the other shape ball and talk about that brilliant career, that nascent brilliant career of yours and the ACL injury. What happened next, Lisa?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, back then, the funding was through the early days of the National Lottery. And if you couldn't play on the pitch, you know, the union only had funding for 15, maybe 18 players. So if you couldn't play, they had to let me go because they had to bring in someone else who could play on the pitch. But at the point I most needed help, that was the point where literally it was like, I'm really sorry, you're going to have to sort this out yourself. And that was really hard because back then, we didn't know what we know now about ACL injuries. That was the first thing. And secondly, you know, for me, just kind of being jettisoned out, trying to figure out what to do. I mean, it actually did change my life. And I say this with you, you've always got to try and make the best of the really rubbish stuff that happens. And at the time when it happened, I thought my world had come to an end. I really did. But ultimately, what it forced me to do was to give up my job, to go back to university, to be able to access physios and physicians who could help me recover. But ultimately, the reason why I got back on the pitch was not because of the system, but because of kind individuals at various points in those 6 years who just thought either it's not right the way you've been treated, or we'd really like to see you back on a pitch. I think that'd be good for Scottish rugby.
Let's talk about women's health then in sport, because I know, Kelly, this is something really close to your heart as well. Do you agree that the NGBs, we've got lots of them, thank you for coming here in the audience today, have to have an entire gear change when it comes to female athlete health?
Yeah, I did say that, didn't I? I completely believe it. Just before I left running the WSL last year, we signed a deal with Well HQ to look at investment in sort of capability and understanding of female athlete health amongst our workforce in the clubs. And I know that our coach development needed to go on a journey, our coach education courses, content needed to go on a journey, a much quicker journey to make sure that understanding female athletes was much more embedded, both in CPD and in course content. And I'm guessing a number of sports are like that. I'm looking at, I work in the moment with FIFA, who've got a massive female health program coming out. It's just, we know it's a massive gap in terms of research. I think it's 6% of all research is on female athletes, but we've got to go on that journey quicker. Lisa's just talked about ACLs. I mean, every time I go on Twitter, an ACL seems to have gone in terms of female footballers. It's frightening. And yeah, it's got to move much, much quicker.
Okay, so we're picking up on some of the real differences in your lifetimes and your careers between men and women in sport. Let's come back to Paula. You were running, you were competing at big world events at the same time as men like Linford Christie and Colin Jackson. What was their experience, do you like, compared to yours and the other female athletes? What are the key differences?
It's always really difficult to put yourself in somebody's position, but most of the females, definitely besides one or two, were all working, so we had to work. There was lack of sponsorship for female athletes, whereas they and their contracts from the sporting companies was a lot larger. So there was differences on the ground. I mean, obviously, they went on to win Olympic medals.
You weren't too shabby.
I'm not Olympian. I didn't win an Olympic medal. But it was always really difficult managing working full-time and obviously trying to train and be an elite athlete. And it was generally down to lack of sponsorship, which hopefully is not going to be as such a big barrier today. But yeah, you know, as my mum says, if it doesn't break it, it'll make you.
Who made it possible for you? You talked about your family. You weren't a wealthy family. You got a new pair of trainers and a new pair of spikes every year, right? And your mum made sure that happened.
Absolutely.
But in terms of both your athletic career and your coaching career, what's made it possible? Because women in sport, we are really fighting now. It's a big campaign now for more women in coaching. What made it possible for you to turn those 6 years into decades?
I think I had a really good coach who obviously saw something within me and I didn't even recognise. I never said, went out and said I wanted to be the coach. I kind of thought I'd finish and then move on and just go back to my normal job. And then I really found that I did really like it. But if he hadn't said, stay behind and look after this group of girls, and these group of girls were, you know, very similar to me, you know, similar backgrounds, majority were black, and our club was still majority white, and it's in a nice, lovely area. So I really connected with them. And then you get success, which then, you know, makes you want to stay. So out of those three girls, six girls, three of them went to become internationals. And he didn't think if I hadn't been there to involve them and understand their journeys and they couldn't understand mine, it probably wouldn't have happened. So I think you get success that then encourages you to keep learning and moving forward. But it isn't easy. So as an ex-athlete, people just assume you're going to be really good. So you can get into the door, but then they expect you to be gold dust. But I was just still learning as to be a coach. So that's the difficulty. The expectation's really high and it's just managing that. And I say to athletes now who are transitioning to coaches, just learn and keep learning. People have expectations, but you keep developing at the pace. And that's what I do. So that's probably why I still coach, because you should never be too far away from it, especially when you're talking to coaches.
We'll pick up in a minute on that idea of being the first and the fact that you've slightly pushed back about that idea of always being described as the first. But Lisa, you're nodding along to some of that. What did you want to pick up on from what Paula was saying?
There's a few things I was just sort of reflecting on as I was listening to that. I mean, the first of all is, my whole career in sport, I've had to either justify my presence in the room, or I've had to justify why women and girls should be able to thrive in that sporting environment. And when Women in Sport was first founded, it was very much sport is the preserve of men and boys and a few odd women. And I characterise that as, why would you want to play rugby? Women don't look good on a rugby pitch. Why would you want to do that? Which then became, well, of course you've snapped your ACL. What were you doing on the rugby pitch? So that was kind of phase one. I think phase two, when I think about it, was, well, sport's open to everybody. You know, everybody's welcome here. The door's always open. And it's not our fault that either women... there's not the women with the right experience to join our board, or women don't want to play the sport. And now I feel like we're in a place where it's almost tipping into, well, we've done gender equality now, haven't we?
What, because the Lionesses have won the Euros?
Lionesses have won the Euros, women's sport is more visible, which is fantastic, of course it is, but there's almost this kind of perception of, well, we've gone far enough now with that gender equality. And yet, you know, sitting listening to Paula, we know that only 13% of coaches at the Paris Summer Olympics were women. 13%! That's ridiculous in 2024. So the truth is, not only are we far from having nailed gender equality, we're going backwards.
Why? What's causing that?
Well, I mean, lots of different factors. I mean, if we just take the number of women who are active in this country, we were doing a really good job of closing the gender gap with lots of really innovative approaches from many people in this room. Then the pandemic hit. We know the impact it had on women's sport, but also in terms of women's confidence and ability to take part in physical activity and what they wanted to do post-pandemic. As a result now, the gender gap is growing, and it's growing faster amongst girls than it is amongst women and men. And we are in a situation now where there are fewer women as chief execs and chairs of governing bodies in this country than there was 5 years ago. And that, to me, is because, you know, every now and again, we think about this through a programme lens. We do some programme, we'll do something to fix those women, and we'll give them opportunity, we'll give them a wee lift up. But nobody actually stops and says, hold on a minute, the problem is the system, because the system's designed for boys and men, because they got there first. Guys, that's great, but we need to now be prepared to innovate and change and create a system where all women and girls can thrive. Because if you create that system, everybody will have a good time.
Hear, hear. We were talking about this idea that people think the problem's solved because the Lionesses have done so well. Is football the solution or is it the problem when it comes to fixing or beginning to get further down that line of fixing equality for women and girls in sport? You've worked in this sport for such a long time. How do you judge it now? Where does the balance sit?
I think it's a solution. I think it's showing what can be done in women's sport. I think it's opened the doors to girls to play a sport that was closed off to them. Over 3 million women and girls now play football. We've got the WSL as highly visible. The Lionesses as fantastic role models and visible. The game is growing globally. I said when I left the FA last year, women's football will be the second biggest sport in the world behind men's football in my lifetime. I still believe that. I look at all the indicators. That doesn't mean that everything's fixed. It doesn't mean everything's fixed in football. I'd written gender gap on my notepad when you guys were talking, and I think every single indicator or metric that you want to look at, there's still a massive gap. Some are getting wider, some are getting closing. But I think football's shown a way of what can be done commercially as well to sort of drive women's sport forward, which has been lacking because for years, you know, we could see women's sport in those pinnacle moments, Olympics, World Cup finals, etc., and then disappear off the face of the earth. One of the reasons I took the WSL job in 2018 was I really thought the WSL, the football, could be the one that breaks through and makes the sport mainstream and visible.
Do you ever wish it had been football? Are you glad it was athletics? When you think about being a woman in sport, are you glad you were in the sport you were in, Paula?
I would have definitely done football. Absolutely, because I had four brothers. I was so good. Because you play with your brothers constantly, but there was no opportunity at all for school to do that. So the other thing I got at was that I was running.
Never too late.
I know. Trust me, far too late.
Never too late. I don't believe that for a second. Let's talk a little bit about the organisations coming together to try and move things forward. Lisa, you worked for Women in Sport for a while, and you worked alongside an incredible figurehead in sport who's still there. We saw her recently at another one of our events, Anita White, and you talk about her as an inspiration. What is it about those incredible women who were there at the beginning? We've heard about Celia already, we've heard about Anita, not a woman, but we've heard about Derek, and it's brilliant to see him here today. You can be an honorary woman today, Derek. What did those women do? I think they must have had to be so bloody brave in their day.
Oh, God, unquestionably. But what I always remember of the likes of Celia and Anita and Derek, actually, and it's lovely to see him, is that back then, Anita would know who the women were that worked in the Sports Council. I mean, that's quite easy because there wasn't many of us, right? But she knew who we were, and it was almost like you'd sort of be walking up the stairs, yeah, and then Anita would stop you and ask you, how's it going, what you're working on, who you're working with, and she'd take a real interest in your career. And when I think of those the women back then, there was no kind of sense of pulling the drawbridge up behind them. They very much tried to encourage more and more women into the industry and really support them. And, you know, she kind of followed me throughout my career and was always there to kind of just check in and see how I'm going. And I have to say, actually, as my career progressed, increasingly, there was a few guys that played that role as well. And that's what's been so instrumental for me, is those people who, at points in my career, where they've recognized I could or should be doing something, or they've recognized I'm struggling with something, but they know, you know, my intent is good. They've always been there to give me that helping hand.
What have the men done for you along the way, Kelly? Or did you have to show them how to help, show them how to be allies? Or did it start happening more spontaneously in the last decade?
I think more spontaneously. I had the privilege to work with Howard Wilkinson to put the female talent pathway in. He was an incredible ally and extremely visionary. There's a story that some people in the room I've bored them with already, so I'll sort of say it really quickly, that we'd never have got the money through the FA board to push the WSL to be full-time had it not been that our president was in the board meeting, Prince William, who absolutely championed and pushed it through. So, I've been lucky enough to have some fantastic male allies who do it because it's the right thing, who can see the potential of it. I mean, women's football is bringing in this incredible new audience for football and an incredibly huge amount of players and coaches and referees and administrators. But it's got this wonderful young female skew, diverse audience that most people would kind of break an arm for. So some people are visionary and can see what it can do for sport, and some are just great male allies because it's sort of morally, ethically the right thing. Doesn't matter how they get there. They've got there and they've helped me on the way.
Paula, what do you think men can do to show commitment to women and girls in sport? We've got a load of them in the room today. We're going to have some brilliant ones on the stage today. What do they need to do? What needs to happen in your sport? What has happened that looks great that needs to be emulated?
I think people generally have really good intention and people can talk a lot, but, you know, we need action. So, like I've never said, I wanted to be treated differently. I just want to be treated equally. So if I'm the best person for the job, I am the best person for the job. It shouldn't be the fact that I'm a female or I'm black. It should just be because I'm the best person. So I just say, just treat us exactly the same.
But it's not terribly long ago that you were being interviewed on a radio station in this country, and somebody said to you, because, you know, you're first woman, first black coach to have a head coach job in your sport, and literally asked you to your face, is this box ticking?
Yeah, and I said it's a reflection on him, if he asked that question, not me. So I think there's always going to be people like that. And you, there's no point in trying to justify your existence because the mindset's closed. So I just keep proving, you know, you just keep being successful. Because people can't, they can comment on you, but they can't comment on your record. Because that's fact. So, there's always going to be people who are negative. I was surprised at that as well. And I thought, wow, 20 years. And you still ask that question. So I do think there's still a lot to do. You know, I should never have been the first female or black head coach in a sport like athletics, so that's not good.
I mentioned at the beginning that sense of being the first, and people kept asking you, how does it feel to be the first? You took that home, it ate you up a bit, didn't it? You kept saying
so
to your
stressful.
Husband, what pressure did that put on you?
It's stressful. I mean, I think it was more of an internal driver because I didn't want to fail because I thought, if it failed, they'll never give it to a female again, and they'll never give it to a black person again. And it took me 4 years to relax and think, you know what, I can only be the best version of myself. But that was a lot of pressure. And people never said it, but I kind of just felt I needed to be better than everybody else. Not just good, I had to be really good.
Kelly, I put a Chatham House rule on this, and I don't think we've said anything that's justified it yet. What made you... Tell them something they don't know already. What made you mad as hell during your career? What really shocked you about your own life in sport or the life of the women and girls around you?
Ooh, I suppose the lack of commitment to drive change at times. I suppose all those corridors sort of being blocked off to drive change for women and girls. Men in position of power that could challenge the status quo, that could push more investment, could sit around the table and think, we're all white men, Is this the right makeup of board to make the best decisions for sport? Lots of things, I think, you know, from sort of the extremes of sort of harassment and bullying through to sort of men who genuinely thought that women were inferior. But counterbalance that against fantastic male allies who did help kick down those doors. So I think, coming back to your question about what can the guys do, well, for my sport, join women in football, our brilliant organisation. We really welcome male allies. We need male allies to champion our agenda around supporting women in leadership. The job isn't done. In governing bodies, I think the work that Sport England did around the code has driven change for governing bodies. That needs to cascade all the way down particularly into our clubs. So yeah, you know, get involved, get on board and help us drive the changes needed.
Thank you. Last point from each of you then on that note. Lisa, what's made you mad as hell? And then let's end on a positive. What's going in the right direction?
Oh, right, how long have you got?
About 3 minutes.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things that really pull my chain, I can tell you. And one of them is, we've all made a career out of pushing the value and impact of sport and the ability to change lives and change communities. And I have to say, I'm a huge advocate of that, right? I buy into that 110%. However, what sport does really well is change the lives for a small number of people. And really, if sport and physical activity is really going to be that superpower it could be in this country, what sport needs to recognise is that it is sport that needs to change. And that sport, together as a system, and I'm looking at a big part of it right here in the room today, needs to be brave enough and innovative enough and collaborative enough to make that change happen, right? Because it can't be right that we do it for the few and not the many. Let's really, really make sport be that impact, bring that impact that it could to this country. And the other thing, just quickly, that really, really gets my goat is lack of urgency. So I've heard it mentioned a couple of times here already today, right? It's the single biggest thing. If we could just get a wee bit of urgency into this, it would make a big difference. Because I look at reports every single week, every month, every year, and the same issues come up, and they're not being tackled. We know what the problems are, right? But we've got to actually bring some urgency to this, and let this be the day that you walk out of here with a renewed determination, not just to make change yourself, but to make it with everybody else.
Hell yeah. Thank you. Paula, what made you mad as hell? What's going in the right direction?
Obviously, I don't get mad like Lisa gets mad. Something,
we need all sorts of women in this battle.
What gets me mad is people diminishing somebody else's success because they're female or because there's not enough, you know, they haven't got the history behind them. You know, like women's boxing, you know, this weekend it was an amazing match between those two female athletes. And they were put down like a sideshow where it should have been the main event. So things like that's infuriating, you know, recognize sport people for what they are. And the good thing is that we're all in the room talking about it. So as long as we're talking about it and it's on the radar, then change can always happen. So I'm always really positive of that.
Just like Lisa says, though, a little bit more urgently.
Definitely. Because I'm old, so we need to move it a bit quicker.
We all are a bit on this panel, to be honest with you. Thank you so much, Lisa, Paula and Kelly. Thank you.
What an incredible group of women. And when you hear passion like that, it feels like anything is possible. If you enjoyed this conversation, then check out our archive of dozens of interviews and discussions about women in sport, including further highlights from our 40th anniversary conference. Go to our website, womeninsport.org, where you can sign up to our newsletter, donate to the charity, and get involved in our work. You can also find us on all the usual socials, so please follow us and tell us what sports you love and what you're doing to create change. Please like, subscribe and rate wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. My name is Julia George. And remember, everyone should be included in the joy, fulfillment and lifelong benefits of sport. See you next time.